Hanukkah really has an interesting background that I think is fascinating. It comes from the word meaning dedication. And it was during the time when the temple was dedicated in 165 BC after it had been desecrated by a Syrian king, Antiochus Epiphanes. This guy was a bad guy. He attempted to force the Greek culture and the pagan religion on the people. He went so far as to even erect an altar of Zeus in the temple and sacrificing a pig on the altar. And, of course, the Jewish people were outraged. You know, they raised an army under Judah Maccabees, and you can read a lot about that in the book of Maccabees, which is, though it's not considered a part of scriptures, it is a great historical account. And as soon as the war was over, they returned to Jerusalem after they defeated the forces of the Syrian army, and then they cleansed the temple and they held a service of dedication, Hanukkah. It's the first Hanukkah. And according to the Talmud, there was oil enough for the lights, for the candle, for just one day. And miraculously, it lasted for 8 days. Hence, you have the nine candle holders on the menorah. But, you know, you see the menorah behind me and you go, well, that's not nine, that's a seven branched. How come you have a seven branched? Everyone asks me that all the time. That comes from, of course, the menorah that was in the temple. It was a seven branched candlestick. And it also represents, as in Revelation, Jesus walking in the midst of the candlesticks were actually referring to the church. So that's why it's both that Jewish background and also that Christian picture. But the most visible aspect of Hanukkah is, of course, the lighting of the menorah. And there's other, you know, things about it. But one thing that's interesting is, though it's not in the Old Testament, because it wasn't a feast that was given by God to Moses, like Passover or the Feast of Tabernacles, but it was a feast that does appear in the New Testament. Jesus actually, in John chapter 10, verse 22, it says that he was at Jerusalem at the Feast of Dedication, which was Hanukkah, and it was winter. But it's an interesting thing because it also ties in to the end times. Because as Jesus makes reference to the one who has the abomination of desolation, that was a type of, the Syrian king was a type of the Antichrist. He was described in Daniel, though the actual dedication or feast wasn't mentioned in Daniel. The actual description of what this king did, right down to the detail in Daniel 8 and also Daniel 11, you find a very detailed description of what he did. And, of course, the powers coming from the Grecian Empire all the way down. And it's one of those fascinating things that people who study history go, wow, was Daniel right on or what? But it comes right down to that. And, of course, the New Testament, though it was written after the time of Antiochus and Maccabees, it makes allusions to Daniel that move forward. And when we come to this time in the tribulation period, understand that we just saw the beast, you know, and erecting what? An image. And causing people to worship it. Just in the same way that Antiochus Epiphanes did back then. And there will be a revolt, you know, among the Jewish people. They'll realize they've been tricked. They'll flee, most likely, to the rock city of Petra, and the Lord will protect them from the dragon who will want to swallow them up. So you find this amazing picture of the Old Testament and those events that took place in the intertestament period being alluded to by Daniel and also looking back from in Revelation. Just a fascinating insight into this. But now we come to Revelation 14, and we left off with the mark of the beast and all that that entails. And I am still anxious to do a little more research on these new protein chips that there's a lot of scientific research being done on. I want to look a little bit more into that because I understand that the protein chips are something like 50,000 times more powerful than silicon chips. They actually use the DNA and can actually write on, I mean, tablets that are so small, it's just you need a microscope to look at them. So the components can, and also potentially, and this is what they're hoping, the components can be tied into your biological system so that you could, the sky's the limit of what could happen as you would have some type of a, you know, the bionic man comes alive kind of a thing. But, you know, this mark of what the VeriChip is doing, this chip that people are talking about getting chipped, when they first came out with it, of course, they radio identification tags. The CEO of the company said, oh, no, we'd never do any. We're not planning on implanting that at all. And that was only in the year 2000. Now it's just people have come to accept it. You know, they figure after September 11th, the guard is down. People want security. They want to be safe. And there's a lot of good benefits. Of course, we noticed that the The three groups that will be motivated will be the banks because of, you know, saving a lot of money on transactions and making that a lot easier. And commerce, it'll be just amazing if you, I mean, think about the good side of it. You can just walk into a store, grab some stuff and walk out and automatically deducts from your account. And there's so many possibility things. You wouldn't need to open your car with keys. You just, as soon as you reach for the handle, it automatically recognizes you. Gun control would be a great thing if they, and they're developing this. If you had a chip in your hand, you grab a gun, only you could fire it. Someone else grabs it, it locks it up. So there's some interesting, really, really good things that can come from technology. The scary thing is how it will be used. Now, I'm not saying that the Verichip is the mark of the beast. Don't ever get me wrong on that. In fact, I don't believe that's the case. What I do believe, though, is that it's the precursor of what technology can very easily be used by the wrong powers. Because that's the issue. And that is what this whole one world system will be all about. It'll be a consolidation of power in one man, whom we typically know as the Antichrist. And he will be worshipped by people, which is ultimately his goal. He's not into anything else other than just what Satan was into. He wanted to be worshipped. Remember when he said to Jesus in the temptation, "All these things I'll give to you if you worship me." Because he wants to be like God. He's been deceived. And of course, the Antichrist will have that same spirit within him. So there's fascinating things. Now, one person said about the mark of the beast that I thought was interesting. He says, we're always going to first begin tagging the institutionalized first because they're prisoners. We have power over them. Then we're going to tag those people in the nursing homes and in the various hospital wards. It's a unique identifier. He says, you know, you can walk down the street and essentially your number is calling out. It's promiscuous. It'll talk to anything that wants to talk to it. And you don't know, you know, who's going to be monitoring your every step and your every movement. But we're moving in this direction very quickly. I would think within 5 years, it's going to be pretty well accepted. You know that it's going to be greatly convenient to have one of these little chips, painless little injection under your skin. Perhaps once it becomes, it's kind of like Easy Pass, you know. At first, no one wants to do it because they're afraid of getting a ticket if they're checked from this point and they find out, hey, how did you get from here to there so quickly? Ah, you were speeding. We're going to send you a ticket in the mail. They promised to never do that. Well, we'll see. The point is, they know you, where you are. In fact, in some court cases, they're even using that technology. The guy can prove, hey, I was on the freeway at that time, you know, that they're saying that I was over here. And, you know, they can monitor your movements. Well, imagine, you know, what this will mean when these things are chipped. And every time you go into a bank, every time you go into a police station, or any time you go into a post office, you go through a scanner and everyone, oh, there's where you are. They've got you marked. They'll be tracking your buying patterns and selling those lists to, you know, Macy's or whatever. It's interesting stuff. But where it will all lead in the end, that's the thing that I think people are really not thinking about. In fact, in a lot of the studies they've done is they realize that teenagers are actually clamoring to get chipped. They want to get chipped. They think it's cool. Yeah, man, give me a chip.
This is really cool, man. I can see I got a chip.
I won't even go there. But the point is, you know what, older folks are thinking, you know what, we know how power can be abused. And many young people today are naive to that. They don't see it. They think it'll be a cool thing. And so fascinating developments that I think are going to be coming down the pike. But that brings us to chapter 14. And chapter 12 identified the main characters of this period. And chapter 13 identified the wicked rulers of the period. And chapter 14 now reveals what I think is kind of a precursor to the coming of the Lord. He reveals the ultimate triumph in Christ as he saves his own and he judges the world. It's kind of a panoramic view of this. And this picture prepares for the climax in chapter 15. And then eventually those last judgments, because remember, we're right in the middle of the tribulation period here, until eventually the Lord will come back and he will reign on the earth. Chapter 14, verse 1. It says, then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written on their foreheads. Contrast to the mark of the beast, here is a mark on the foreheads of those who are God's, having his name written on their foreheads. This 144,000 that we already were introduced to in chapter 11. 144,000, chapter 7 as well. The same 144,000 from every tribe, 12,000. These are apparently Jewish males that have been called to go throughout all of the earth and proclaim the message of the gospel. That it's God's mercy even in that tribulation period when people have been left behind because they did not receive the love of the truth. Many will still have an opportunity to turn, and many will. The Bible says multitudes will come through the tribulation, will be martyred, be a tough, tough time, but they'll come through it. Now here John sees this vision of the Lamb standing on Mount Zion. So things are coming to a climax here. And 144,000, having finished obviously their work on earth, are there standing with him, having his Father's name written on their foreheads. What a beautiful picture. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the voice of many waters and like the voice of loud thunder, which if you remember Revelation 1, that is very likely Jesus' voice. That's the same description. And I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps. That's where sometimes people get the imagery of being in heaven, you know, floating in a cloud playing a harp. You know, they'll read one of these verses and they'll speculate out on that. Fact is, it'll be beautiful. Instead of the discord of the Antichrist, and everything is disharmonious, the 666, it's incomplete. It's just, you want to finish that last note. There's something missing there. It's just, did you do that assignment I asked you to do? Remember, you know, try to drive somebody crazy by singing a tune but leave off the last note. And you know how that drives people nuts? They've got to finish it. It's incomplete. Well, now in chapter 14, there is a completion to the chord. The music is played and it's harmonious. And there's a sense of balance, a sense of peace here. And though all the misery is on the earth, the glorious description of God's victory is given here. As the Lamb is on Mount Zion and the voice of many waters, like the voice of thunder and the sound of the harpist. And verse 3 says, they sang, as it were, a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn that song except the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. So a very special song that only these have the capacity to comprehend. I think that concept of something that these will be able to sing that no one else will is kind of an insight into the picture of heaven. In its multi-variations of reward to the various people who have responded to the Lord's call in their life. Because there is certainly a difference between how people respond and yield themselves to the Lord. There are those that are saying, Lord, here am I. I'm ready to do whatever. And they're off on the mission field or they're serving the Lord in their jobs, you know, but they're faithful witnesses. They're obedient. They're faithful husbands and wives and raising their children. And they're looking for opportunities. Lord, here's my life. I want to be obedient to you. Well, in heaven, I believe their reward will be an increased capacity to enjoy heaven. And there'll be others that, well, so to speak, will... Paul describes, you know, they're going to make it through, but there's not going to be much reward. Now, does that mean there's going to be like this grief or sadness in heaven? No, there's going to be no more tears or sorrows or problems in heaven. But what will be the difference? Perhaps a diminished capacity to comprehend all that the Lord has and all that He is. Oh, they won't miss out. They'll still enjoy it. I mean, but it's like children in a way. You know, children don't have a capacity to fully enjoy things that adults do. They're content what they're doing. You know, when I was a child, I thought as a child. I spoke as a child. I responded to things as a child. I remember going out in the kind of a field that was by this marsh when I was growing up. And I would just have the most fun just making things in the sand and, you know, doing little things in the mud when it got rainy and, you know, making little mud huts and mud pies and, you know, I mean, just, you play in the mud. Then you come in, you're all muddy and your parents go, oh, no, come in here. Well, to you, the mud was like glorious. But, you know, I don't have that same temptation to go out and play in the mud anymore. My capacity to enjoy life is beyond mud pies now. But is it possible that in heaven, just like these 144,000 were faithful in that respect. And by the way, notice there's not 139,995. He didn't lose five of them. All 144,000 are there. they have this increased capacity to understand this song. Only they can sing. It will be a special thing to them. Just like I believe heaven will be a special thing for individuals that God has called. Who can tell? I mean, the eye has not seen or ear heard the things that God has prepared for those who love Him. We can't even fathom what it will be like. I think an interviewer years ago asked Billy Graham if he thought that what he was going to do in heaven. He says, well, I think there'll be golf in heaven because I greatly enjoy golf and I think it'll be just an expanded form. And you know, you can't argue with that in a way. But or will it be just golf will be like playing in mud pies in comparison to the amazing features that heaven will be like? All I can say is that we can't even fathom it. But they sing a new song. And these are the ones who are not defiled with women, for they were virgins. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever He goes. These were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. Now, there is some controversy in the sense of how people look at this. Are they virgins in the sense that we as the church are the virgin bride of Christ? We're separated unto the Lord. Are they virgins in a pure sense spiritually? Or... and not being defiled with women would be kind of like not being defiled with sexual promiscuity in any respect, not being defiled by those types of things, anything that kept them away from the Lord. Or is he talking literally about these guys were set apart unto the Lord and they chose not to marry, they're virgins, they kept themselves sexually pure, which would certainly stand out in a sexually provocative society. The abstinence movement, many young people are jumping on because they want to make a statement. I want to keep myself till I'm married. I don't want to just cheapen myself and give myself to anybody. I'm going to wait. I'm going to save myself for my husband or for my wife. I think it's a great, great testimony. You know, there are many, however, that mock that. They say, oh, that'll never work. You know, I tell you, we see each year that when we do the purity seminar for men and women, just a greater commitment of young people to say, you know what, I'm going to keep myself. And when they start relating with the opposite sex, they hold themselves in honor and hold their partner in honor and dignity, and they develop the friendship rather than digressing to the physical. Because once you go to the physical, it's like you can't come back to the friendship. You've already disobeyed God, and it's hard now. You've ruined that relationship in some respects. You need to repent of that and come back to the Lord and yield yourself to Him once again. Become that fresh person unto the Lord and say, Lord, cleanse me. Make me into that person. But, you know, here these guys are set apart unto the Lord. And again, we're told that they're from every tribe of Israel. So these are Jewish evangelists who are separated unto the Lord in this capacity. These were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. The idea of the first fruits are they're a type of all of those that are going to be called in that purity. So in a way, they're a model for how we should live. Now, that doesn't mean you're not getting married. There are some people that have assigned being celibate as a more spiritual position than a person getting married. And that, of course, is unbiblical because the Bible says the marriage bed is undefiled. You know, keeping yourself in marriage is God's design, and, you know, that's a spiritual position. The apostles were married. Paul was the only guy that was obviously single, and he even made a statement saying, hey, God's called me to be single. You know, it's a gift that I have. I have a right to take a wife like Peter and James, but, you know, I'm not because this is what God has called me to. But he separated himself. That was a gift of singleness. I know some people, some singles always wonder if they have the gift of singleness, and some are actually terrified that they might. And I can assure you, if you think that you might have it and you're terrified about it, you probably don't have it. Because if you had the gift of singleness, you wouldn't care. It'd be like, hey, this is cool. You know, I'm content to live as a single. Now, he says this. He goes on to say, in their mouth was found no deceit, for they are without fault before the throne of God. You know, there's a lot to that. A separatedness unto the Lord, no deceit. I mean, the world is just filled with lies. Sadly, even among Christians, this is a compromise that far too often happens, where we're afraid to speak the truth in love. And a multitude of little lies start kind of coming about, and you think they're no big deal, but then it always turns into some other thing where you're trying to save your skin, and so you're tempted to lie there, or, you know, you do something and someone says, "Did you do this?" No. You know, you're afraid. That's why we lie sometimes. We're afraid. But deceit, imagine no deceit found in their lies. Now, of course, God is working that in us. We're not all where we should be. But in a way, these guys set a foundation. They set kind of a goal. They're becoming more and more like Jesus. And that's my desire. I want to be like him. I want to be able to speak. I want to walk in the light with people. I don't have any, you know, funny things going on. And I say this to one person and this to another person. And I play politics. I want to walk in the light. You know, and I think that's a good policy. You know, it's always true. Bad news travels faster than good news. You know, something happens, you know, maybe someone's hurt, their feelings are hurt or something, and they tell somebody, and the next thing you know, the whole bad news spreads. And then that person, it's all dealt with, you know, the situation where they should have just come to the horse's mouth to begin with, settle that situation, and then they do, and they're happy, but they've left a wake of people that are still thinking wrongly about the situation. And you get all this confusion, then it spreads these rumors and gossip, and it's amazing what a person's tongue can do. I mean, it's horrible. The power of the tongue could set a little tiny match can set an entire forest on fire. So that little member between your nose and your chin, what that little muscle can do, left unchecked, left untamed, left under that power of the Lord. Well, these guys, they would not let any deceit, guile. It's the same word there that Jesus, it was described of him. There was no guile in him. There was nothing pretentious. He was very just right out front. Well, then I saw. Now, here's the description of these 144,000. And of course, they're standing on Zion. That's the place where the Lord is going to reign from. Zion is that place that when David first took the stronghold of Zion in 2 Samuel 5, all the way to when the angel was going to plague the city, and because of David's sin, and David prayed to God, and the Lord led him to buy the threshing floor of Ornan, which eventually that sacrifice was made, and the plague stopped, and eventually where the temple was built. It's a place that, well, when you're on the Temple Mount, it's almost you almost sense you're in the center of the universe. It's a place where God has said, "I will set my king upon my holy hill of Zion." And right now, though it is not under the control of Israel as a nation, one day it will be under the control of the Messiah, as he will reign out of Zion and out of Jerusalem. And the whole world will say, "Come, let's go up to Jerusalem, the mountain of the Lord, the house of the God of Jacob. And he'll teach us his ways and we'll walk in his paths, for out of Zion shall go his law." And that's where these 144,000 are singing from. Now, in verse 6, he says, "Then I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, tongue, and people. And saying with a loud voice, 'Fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea, and the springs of water.'" Now he's pronouncing the gospel, but warning judgment is coming. You see, good news is only good in proportion to what it keeps you from. You know, good news that you can escape the coming judgment. Good news that it's not by your own might or strength that you have to perform and meet a certain expectation that God has made. Rather, you actually have the ability to let the full righteousness of Christ come upon you as you open your heart to him, as you turn your life over to him. His righteousness comes upon you as he takes your sins upon him. I mean, this is amazing. And so the gospel is here even in the tribulation. It is announced. It is presented to the entire world through this angelic being. Now, before the tribulation, God is not choosing to use angels to get the message across. He's not writing in the sky the gospel. He's not, you know, appearing in tortillas, you know, with his face. As some actually, remember years ago, the Jesus tortilla? that someone said they made this tortilla and they were frying it, and it looked like the face of Jesus in it, and they kind of preserved it, and they had thousands and thousands of people coming to see this tortilla that the face of Christ has appeared to. It is funny, but God has made His Word known through the Bible. He has made His truth known and through living epistles. Who are living epistles? We are. Bible says we're living epistles read of all men. You're living little Bibles. Not that you're, you know, talking encyclopedias and you got all the lingo down, but rather you're living it in such a way that people see the power of God in your life. What a difference that is. You know, your words go a lot farther when they see the character behind it. And the character's only behind it when you're truly letting the Word go through you. You know, there are people that will preach Christ from envy. You know, they think it's, you know, it's the popular thing, and so they want that popularity. They've got that ego need to be noticed. But there's no depth there. God has to work that in us first. And I've found, and it's true, whom the Lord wants to use greatly, He must sometimes wound deeply so that the Word gets in. Because sometimes our pride and our arrogance and all the other issues of our lives, you know, it takes the Lord to time to deal with us. Well, here this angel comes forth now, and this is a whole new dimension now. The gospel going forth by an angel. Now it is, I believe, when it says the everlasting gospel, some make this a distinction between the gospel of Christ that we give and this gospel, which is the gospel of the kingdom, they say. My problem with that is simply what Paul said in Galatians 1. He says, if we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel to you than what we've preached, let him be accursed. So I hardly doubt that this could be a different gospel. I highly doubt that this could be something that's unique or new now, that it's a new message in the tribulation period. I believe the same message is there. Fear God, as he says here, judgment is coming. You've got a way of escape through the Son. You've got a way of escape that Jesus died for you. And certainly you want to know him as the Lamb who was slain for you. You don't want to meet him as the Lamb coming back in judgment, as he will judge this earth. When he says, worship him that made the earth, you know, think about that for a moment. Doesn't that make sense? Who are you worshiping? Are you worshiping something that was created? Whether it be a person, whether it be a thing, a possession, or some institution? Are you worshiping some aspect of power, money, sex? What's your driving passion? Well, it makes sense to worship him who made it all. Because if he made everything that you see in this world with just a few building blocks, imagine what he will do when he creates the new heavens and the new earth. You know, we digress sometimes in relationships. When it becomes, you know, when you first are seeing someone and the prospect of marriage comes up and you got that glow. You know, there's a few people around here that I see God is bringing them together and they've got that glow. They're just like, you can see it. That's cool. But what happens often in marriage, you know, when you get married and after a few years, instead of being just excited with each other's presence, you're more focused on now the things you're accumulating together as a couple. Your house and your cars and your jobs, and you start focusing on those things. You know what happens to the relationship? It starts deteriorating because you're losing focus on what's really important. I think it's true with our walk with the Lord. We need to keep that the focus, not the things He gives to us or blesses us with, because those are just trinkets in comparison to the gold of His presence. Worship Him who made everything. Worship Him who made the heaven and the earth. And this is really what's being expressed here. And another angel followed, saying, Babylon is fallen, the great city, because she has made all the nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Now in this prelude, he's going to spend two chapters on Babylon falling, both economically and politically, or religiously, you could say. And Babylon will fall. This is expression here prophetically. That great city. Why? Because she has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. Seducing people. Spiritual fornication, most likely, but certainly tied up in that, is the incredible, insatiable worship of sex, which we see very much in our society. I mean, this society is sex-filled. And Babylon is saturated with an appetite for sexual immorality. All of the worships of the pagans, the style of pagan worship, was sexual practices and fertility rites. It's amazing how powerful that is, that desire the Lord gave to a man and a woman, that they would come together and live their lives together and give their bodies to each other and then procreate, have children and create that family. I mean, folks, this is tragic in our nation when that's becoming the minority, a husband and a wife with children. That used to be largely the majority. People are getting away from that to their own ruin. You can't improve on what God designed. There's nothing like a family that stays together. Coming from a broken family, I know the insecurity and the doubt and the problems that I went through. And I see that, you know, and I thankfully God uses those things in your life so you can minister to others. But boy, what a difference for those that have had that great benefit. No greater gift can you give to your children, husband, wife, than love each other with that passion the Lord has called you to. Because this society is going down the wrong road with this. We're seeing more and more of a getting away and just the saturation of sexual promiscuity. Grass always looks greener on the other side. Always the stolen water is sweet. Always looks so tantalizing, that which you cannot have. But you've got to choose to let your mate satisfy you. As the Proverbs say, a man is to choose to let his wife's breasts satisfy him. That's a choice he makes. And when he is focused and he is committed, there is nothing more enjoyable than that which God has granted. The world just taints it, it destroys it, discolors it. I think of what women are doing to their bodies for the sake of the pleasure of a man, rather than thinking in terms of, well, what did God give breasts for? Certainly for enjoyment in that relationship, as for a husband and wife, but also for breastfeeding, giving that milk to the kids and having that warmth and that relationship. But you know, women now are getting away from that. They're just thinking of the breast as that which pleases the man. And so whatever they have to do to pump it up and fix it and make it look pretty and, you know, forget what it might mean in the future to breastfeeding and giving milk to the kids. I think it's tragic what our whole focus is. But this is Babylon. Now, in John's day, Babylon represented the whole world, the system under Nebuchadnezzar, in which if they refused to worship the false image, they were thrown into the fiery furnace. In John's day, Roman Babylon, and if you didn't acquiesce and say Caesar is Lord, you were also thrown to the lions. In our day, the American Babylon, the porn capital of the world, if you don't acquiesce to this and you try to say, hey, marriage is right, you'll be vilified in many circles. Yet slowly our nation is sanitizing itself of all Christian references. In the tribulation, will the spirit of Babylon return to the actual Babylon as the Antichrist gets established over in that part of the world? Well, this is going to just be the prelude. There's a whole lot more about Babylon that we'll pick up when we get to chapter 17 and 18. Then a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast in his image and receives his mark on his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. He shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. Now, I think it's important to note, because I remember back when the first thought of the Mark of the Beast came out in the movies, you know, the portrayal of it and the idea of people unwittingly getting this mark. And oh no, they're lost forever and they didn't know. I can assure you from the scriptures that if you read what he says here, it's very plain that that judgment will come upon whom? If anyone worships the beast. So it involves an act of your will in worshiping this beast or the image that he has made that we saw in the last chapter, and receives his mark on his forehead. So you're identifying with him. It is a willful act of identifying with the Antichrist, this beast, this world leader. It's not just a matter of, gee, I really didn't know what I was doing, and now I'm lost for eternity. I think people will know. That's why I don't think if you got chipped from Verichip Company, you know, that you're like, oh no, you might have gotten the mark. I don't believe that. I just think it's stupid for other reasons. You know, wouldn't want to be tracked, wouldn't want to be in a position where the powers that be could turn evil and then use it against you in some capacity. The only way I would get it is if I had a way to remove it myself if I had to. Sure would be convenient though, wouldn't it? Notice, he says, a third angel followed them and says, if anyone worships, this is the key, folks. It is an involvement of your will. That when you do make that choice, at that point you will drink of the wine of the wrath of God, full indignation. You have chosen to go to the degree that now you are worshiping the creation rather than the Creator. You'll be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of his holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night who worship the beast and his image and whoever receives the mark of his name. You know, look at this judgment, the smoke of their torment. Eternal punishment is described here. And this is not just described here. Daniel describes there will be some rising to everlasting life. Others, they'll be rising also to everlasting shame and contempt. Daniel chapter 12. Matthew 25, 41, Jesus says he will say to those on his left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. That's whom this is prepared for. This was not intended for people. But why is it that people will go there? Because they have not received the love of the truth. They have turned their hearts from it. And Matthew 8, verse 12 says, the sons of the kingdom will be cast in the outer darkness and weeping and gnashing of teeth. Jude describes it as raging waves of the sea, foaming up their own shame, wandering stars for whom is reserved the blackness of darkness forever. Lake of fire. These false doctrines that we hear from time to time are dangerous, in which they're on the one side, there's the restorationism people, where they believe that, you know, hell is a punishment, it'll be horrible, but it won't last forever, and eventually all will be saved. That's not a scriptural doctrine. I mean, I would want that. I mean, my heart of hearts, it would seem like that would be right. That's why many people follow that. Because they don't want to trust what the Bible says, they just want to have their own ideas. And then the other side, people talk about annihilation. Cults believe this, that the wicked will ultimately be unmade. That they'll be annihilated, that there'll be no more remembrance of anything. Well, each one of these false doctrines does something. It makes people lose zeal for reaching the lost. It cuts the edge off of the urgency of telling others about the Lord and letting your life shine in such a way that makes a difference in people's lives. Ravi Zacharias made a point on the radio today that I caught. I thought it was so appropriate. It's just no one sins alone. You know, there's no such thing as a victimless crime or victimless sin. If you think, well, I'm not hurting anybody, it's just my own sin and I'm not bothering anybody with it. Oh, you have no idea what you're doing. Because you're hurting yourself, which in turn is making yourself less effective for making a difference. And who can tell who will miss hearing the gospel because you're out of touch with what God wants to do in your life. I got a letter today that really touched my heart from a brother in the Lord that the Lord used him mightily in a situation that happened. He came upon an accident, you recall, last year, where a mother had given birth in her car on the way to the hospital minutes before it slammed into a telephone pole, killing her husband. And he was right there in the scene and actually helped save her life and get her help. And he says a couple of weeks ago he came across another serious accident involving a 31-year-old man in his 50s, and he was approaching an intersection and a dump truck collided with the box van head on. He jumped out and he ran, and the man was pinned in his van and he dialed for help, and the man asked him if he would call his mother and tell her what happened, and he did. He called. It was tough. So he was flown to a nearby hospital. Everything seemed to be okay. And he said, 2 or 3 days later, I woke in the middle of the night with a tug at my heart to go visit this man in the hospital and drop off a Bible and share with him. He says, I didn't go. I found out he developed a blood clot later that day and fell into a coma and died 2 days later. And he says, I'm writing to you so that you can share with the fellowship. But there are no guarantees when it comes to life. If you feel God calling, respond. Don't make the same mistake I made. I'll never know if this man is in heaven until I get there. You know, the funny thing is, I mean, he's not beating himself up about it, but you know what? It's a great lesson. And I've been there too. You know, I haven't been ready for an opportunity the Lord put right in front of me. And so in many ways, when you let sin dominate your life, you really don't know the damage you're causing to others. By your lack and your inability to make an influence on their lives. On the contrary, when you do walk in the Spirit and yield your life to the Lord, the difference you can make, that you could influence just one young person to follow the Lord by your model and example as a father or a mother or a friend or a co-worker. I still am greatly indebted to the doctor at Michigan State University who was a professor as well, orthopedic surgery. And he taught a little study in his home. Dr. Tinning was known as the evangelist. You know, anyone who come into his office, he had a particular chair that they'd sit in, and man, they wouldn't get out of that chair without getting saved. You know, he had such an influence. But his life is just on fire for the Lord. And he impacted me. Now, he wasn't a full-time pastor or in ministry, but he was in ministry. We're all really in ministry in some degree. What a difference. And, you know, I'll tell you, I'm indebted to him because he inspired me to want to go farther with the Lord, to seek the Lord even more, to yield my life even more. And, man, I want to be like him. And I'll tell you, that inspired me. Yeah, here you see these that now have given their life over to this false image. They think, oh, well, I'm doing it for my, not hurting anybody. Nobody sins alone. So here is the patience of the saints, verse 12. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. That is, in a time of great persecution, when the Antichrist is killing off anyone who won't receive the mark, can't buy or sell without it. He's influencing people to try to worship him. There will be people pressured, but they'll still know what it is. They're making a choice. But to resist that pressure, just like you have to make a decision today to resist the temptation to sin, to resist following the crowd to do evil, resist just conforming to this sin-saturated, sexual, provocative world. You make a choice. And I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. You know, your works will follow you. What you've been, what you've done, what you've yielded up to the Lord will follow you as rewards for all eternity. Laying up treasures in heaven where nothing can take away from you. And God is not so unjust as to forget your labor of love. Even if it means just bringing a cup of cold water to a prophet in the name of a prophet. Say, I believe God has called you, and you honor them, and you're there. Just like the very few friends that stuck with Jeremiah when he was in his ministry. Very few people stuck with him during the hard times. And those that did, I believe they will not lose their reward. Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and on the cloud sat one like the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. See, judgment's been committed to the Son. That's what Jesus said. All judgment has been given over to the Son. This is no question that this is referring to Jesus. And another angel came out of the temple crying with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, thrust in your sickle and reap, for the time has come for you to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. So he who sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. Then another angel came up out of the temple, which is in heaven, also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came up from the altar who had power over fire, and he cried with a loud voice to him who had a sharp sickle, saying, thrust in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. Now, on the one hand, you've got the grains, the first reaping, the second, the vintage, the grapes. I don't know how much you could make of the difference between reaping the grapes and reaping the grains, but the idea here is that it's harvest time for the earth. And when it says the grapes are fully ripe, that word actually means dried up. It's overripe. It's putrid now. And it must be harvested. So God's patience with the world is ripe. It's gone too long.